This document is a comprehensive morning intelligence briefing from August 24, 2026, analyzing major technological shifts, including a consumer gaming boycott, legacy software emulation, and decentralized space exploration. And, well, diving right in, the intelligence briefing attempts to weave highly disparate topics into a grand narrative of technological structural reordering, but the thematic transitions between consumer gaming boycotts, legacy code emulation, and aerospace engineering can feel slightly jarring to the reader.
Jarring is definitely the right word for it. It really asks a lot of the audience right up front.
It does. So, a key theme running through this material seems to be this underlying shift away from massive, fragile systems. But as I read it, I'm struck by how abruptly the text jumps from the hashtag PS Blackout protest and the liberation of Metal Gear Solid 4 on the Switch 2 directly into NASA funding a swarm of 10,000 femtosatellites.
Right, it's a massive leap. You literally go from video game emulation to orbital mechanics in the blink of an eye.
Exactly. Reading this transition feels a bit like walking through a museum where the Renaissance art wing opens directly into a display of modern jet engines.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Thanks. I mean, I understand both are feats of human ingenuity, but the sudden pivot is just disorienting. So I guess my question is, does this abrupt shift risk losing the reader's conceptual grounding entirely?
I think it absolutely does. It places a tremendous cognitive load on the audience. The weakness in this specific area is that the shift from the Metal Gear Solid 4 legacy hardware section into NASA's NIAC $3.2 million funding for Saturn ring exploration lacks immediate transitional tissue in the body of the text.
Right. It's this kind of boom. We're in space now.
Exactly. The overarching connection regarding a post-Moore's Law era is relegated entirely to the strategic morning synthesis at the very end of the document.
Away at the bottom.
Yeah, the very end. Because of the structural choice, the reader is left to bridge an enormous conceptual gap between video game emulation and aerospace engineering completely by themselves in the middle of the read. They have, like, no framework to process why they are suddenly reading about orbital mechanics.
I can see what you're going for here. Let's see how we can strengthen this. If I'm looking at this from an editorial perspective, my first instinct might be to just drop a transitional sentence at the end of the gaming section that says something like, this kind of technological paradigm shift isn't just happening in consumer electronics, it's also happening in space exploration.
Right, the classic pivot sentence.
Yeah, but frankly, that feels like a cheap band-aid. It tells the reader that a shift is happening, but it completely fails to explain the underlying logic connecting the two domains.
That's clearly laid out. I wonder, though, if we've considered pulling that conceptual connective tissue from the concluding synthesis directly into the transitions between the sections to create a seamless thematic evolution.
Oh, interesting. So move the thesis up?
That connects the paragraphs. If the core argument is about a shift from monolithic fragility to decentralized resilience, that concept needs to be introduced the moment the topic changes, so the reader never loses their footing.
Okay, but how do we actually execute that on the page without it feeling forced? We are asking the author to smoothly link a PlayStation 3 to a NASA space probe. The contexts are wildly different.
They are, but the engineering philosophies aren't. A concrete example of how to implement this would be to explicitly juxtapose the architectural philosophies of both systems right at the pivot point.
Okay, walk me through that.
So in the current text, the PlayStation 3's cell processor is described in great detail as a highly bespoke, monolithic architecture. You have one central PowerPC processing element acting as a dispatcher, right?
Right, and the eight synergistic processing elements relying on hyper-compact local storage.
Yeah, the text rightly points out that any microsecond latency hiccup across the element interconnect bus catastrophically stalls the entire rendering pipeline. It is an engineering marvel, but it is fundamentally fragile.
Right, it's brilliant, but incredibly brittle.
Exactly. So the author could use that exact fragility to introduce the aerospace section.
Oh, I see. So you pair the failures of philosophy together. You transition by highlighting that the cell processor and the historical Cassini-Huygens space probe share the exact same systemic vulnerability.
Precisely that. The author describes the Cassini mission as a multi-billion-dollar monolithic probe. It was a triumph. But just like the CELL processor, it was constrained by its singular vulnerability.
Because if it hit anything.
Yeah,
It can never risk direct penetration into Saturn's dense particle belts, because a collision with a single centimeter-scale icy boulder at orbital velocities would cause instantaneous catastrophic mission loss.
Wow. So once you establish that shared vulnerability of the monoliths, you introduce the shared solution.
Which brings us to the modern counterparts.
Right.
Yes. From there, the author could compare the Nintendo Switch 2's elegant, low-power Tegra T239 emulation.
Which effectively bypasses the CLL's fragile architecture through distributed processing, right?
Exactly. Compare that to NASA's decentralized 10,000-unit resilient femtosat swarm. I mean, the femtosats are wafer scale, weighing less than 100 grams each.
It's unbelievable.
And even if 70% of them are destroyed by ring debris, the remaining 3,000 nodes maintain an uninterrupted mesh network. By framing the transition as a natural evolution of a single concept, decentralized resilience replacing monolithic fragility, the gap is seamlessly bridged.
Man, that fundamentally changes the reading experience. It takes two disparate news items and turns them into a cohesive thesis on how human engineering is evolving across all sectors simultaneously.
It really does. And comparing architectural philosophies is just one of several potential ways to bridge this topical gap.
What else could they do?
Well, another route the author could take is focusing on the economic transitions, comparing the massive sunk financial costs of maintaining monolithic legacy systems in both gaming and aerospace, and how those costs are driving both industries towards cheaper distributed networks.
The economic angle would be highly effective as a transition because it grounds the engineering and real-world resource constraints. Regardless of whether the author chooses the architectural philosophy route or the economic resource route, the goal is to ground the reader in the why rather than just hitting them with the what.
Couldn't agree more.
So, building on this idea of structural fragility in technology, I think we should look at the fragility of consumer rights highlighted in the first segment regarding the Sony boycott.
Let's do it.
The coverage of the hashtag PS Blackout boycott effectively captures the mechanics of the protest and the financial incentives of Sony's 2028 disc phase-out, yet it leaves the broader economic consequences for the consumer largely unexplored.
Yeah, they really glide right over the actual wallet impact, don't they?
They do. As I understand it from the notes, the argument here is that the global boycott was ignited by an automated terms of service dispatch to millions of users, bluntly reminding them that their digital purchases are licensed, not owned.
Which is always a fun message to get on your console.
Oh, totally. And this happened right as supply chain analysts indicated Sony was completely ceasing production of physical Blu-ray game discs to capture an estimated $8 to $14 in incremental margin by cutting out maritime logistics and retail splits.
Right, they want to cut out the middleman entirely.
Exactly. Now, the author dedicates a massive amount of real estate to the preservationist advocacy groups and their ideological battle to save digital media from corporate erasure. But I have a significant issue with this weighting. By highlighting the ideological battle so heavily, doesn't the text risk completely overlooking the immediate, tangible wallet impact on the average consumer?
It absolutely does. It is a critical blind spot in the analysis. The weakness here is that while the text briefly mentions the $4.2 billion pre-owned market and touches on the barriers for budget-conscious players, it doesn't fully stress-test the corporate counterarguments.
It just sort of accepts them at face value.
Yeah, nor does it map out the long-term economic reality of an artificial monopoly enforcing digital price floors without physical trade-in friction. The preservation angle is vital to the story, sure, but the economic reality is what actually drives mass consumer behavior and regulatory scrutiny.
So if we are going to fix this, we need to restructure the section to tackle those economics without losing the ideological thread.
Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of the platform holder and used their own arguments as the framing device?
Oh, turn it around on them?
Exactly. The suggestion to improve this section is to enrich the analysis by introducing the corporate counter perspective, only to systematically dismantle it by detailing the secondary economic effects of a closed digital ecosystem.
Okay, let's workshop how that actually looks in the drafting process. If I am writing the platform holder's defense, I'm arguing that these digital margins aren't just corporate greed. They are absolutely necessary to fund increasingly bloated AAA game development.
Right, because games are incredibly expensive to make now.
Hundreds of millions of dollars.
So the argument goes, we need that extra $14 per unit just to keep the studios open without raising the base price of a game to $100. If I'm the author, do I just state that defense and move on?
You state it clearly, but you don't let it stand unchallenged. As a concrete example, the author could introduce that exact corporate defense regarding development costs and then immediately counter it by demonstrating how the loss of the secondary market creates unchecked artificial price floors.
So getting into the actual mechanics of the market.
Yeah, the author needs to explain the mechanics of friction. In a world with physical discs, if a $70 game isn't selling, retail stores have to discount it to clear literal shelf space.
Because they have boxes sitting in the back room taking up space.
Exactly. Players trade it in, creating a thriving secondary market that forces the primary market to continually adjust its pricing to remain competitive.
But when you remove physical media on a closed console ecosystem, that friction vanishes entirely. There is no competitor store on a PlayStation interface.
Which means the platform holder can hold a digital game at $70 indefinitely, completely divorced from market demand or time elapsed since launch.
Wow.
The author needs to explicitly spell out that this isn't just about preserving art. It is about the enforcement of an artificial monopoly.
That's a highly compelling counterargument because it relies on basic economic principles rather than just ideological outrage. But I wonder if the author could also strengthen this by drawing a historical parallel to the PC market's digital transition.
Oh, like Steam?
Yeah, platforms like Steam normalized a digital-only future over a decade ago, and PC players largely accepted it without a massive boycott. Why is it different here?
That's fascinating. What are the potential limitations or counterarguments to that idea?
Well, the obvious difference is that the PC is an open platform.
Right. Steam has to compete with Epic Games, GOG, and independent key sellers, which organically drives prices down through standard market competition.
Exactly. A locked console hardware ecosystem has no such competitive pressure. Therefore, revocable licenses in a closed system are fundamentally more dangerous and expensive for end users.
Because the hardware manufacturer acts as the absolute gatekeeper.
Exactly. Exploring these economic precedents, whether through the mechanics of retail shelf space or the historical parallel of open PC storefronts, represents just a few ways to broaden the angle beyond pure software preservation. The goal is to anchor the abstract ideological debate in the hard everyday economics of the consumer.
Right. Bring it back to their wallets.
Okay. So this impending threat of losing access to digital media ties perfectly into the second segment, where the author details the monumental engineering effort required to preserve just one game, Metal Gear Solid 4, from hardware extinction.
It's a great transition, honestly.
It is. But the technical autopsy of the Metal Gear Solid 4 liberation is exceptionally detailed, though there is an opportunity to anchor this engineering triumph more firmly to the user's emotional experience of media preservation.
Yeah, it gets a bit lost in the weeds there.
Let's look closely at the section discussing the technical breakdown of Konami's dynamic binary recompilation layer. The author goes into incredible depth about how legacy SPE vector microcode is translated directly into modern ARM64 Neon instructions running across the customized NVIDIA Tegra T239 silicon.
That is a mouthful.
Right? The text details how this translation allows a notoriously complex game to hit a locked 60 frames per second on a handheld drawing under 8.5 watts. As an engineering deep dive, it is objectively fascinating.
Oh, for sure.
But as a piece of narrative writing, reading this section feels a bit like reading a highly technical surgical report. You are constantly amazed by the sheer skill of the surgeon, but you completely lose sight of the patient lying on the table. My concern is that this level of extreme technical granularity derails the emotional stakes of saving a cultural legacy.
I agree entirely. It creates a severe pacing issue in the manuscript. The dense technical exploration of the CEL broadband engine, while accurate and genuinely impressive for a highly technical audience, temporarily disconnects from the high-stakes preservation narrative established in the preceding hashtag PS Blackout section.
It really does. It just kills the momentum.
It makes the material feel completely disjointed. You have just spent hundreds of words establishing this massive impending threat of losing access to digital media, and instead of showing how this emulation effort directly fights that threat, the text completely halts its momentum to deliver a dry recitation of SIMD matrix operations and hardware-accelerated memory virtualization.
So the technical specifications are essentially existing in a vacuum, totally divorced from the narrative stakes.
Exactly. Is the connection between the technical achievement and the cultural imperative fully established in the material, or is that an area to potentially bolster? I would argue it needs aggressive bolstering.
Definitely.
The suggestion here is to directly intertwine the technical specifications with the ideological goals of the preservationists to ensure the narrative momentum isn't lost in the hardware weeds.
So how does a writer actually accomplish that intertwining without compromising the technical accuracy? Because technical writing requires cold precision. If an author starts injecting flowery, emotional adjectives into a breakdown of vector microcode, it can very quickly sound melodramatic or, worse, unprofessional.
That's a great point. You don't alter the technical facts. You alter the framing of those facts. As a concrete example, the author could frame the Switch 2's Tegra 239 silicon not just as an engineering marvel, but as a crucial digital lockpick essential for cultural survival.
Oh, I like that phrasing, digital lockpick.
Right? When the text discusses the dynamic recompilation layer, it should explicitly point out that if Sony's 2028 digital-only future comes to pass, this specific algorithmic translation becomes the literal-only defense against media extinction.
That completely recontextualizes the data. You take a metric like the instantaneous 1.8-second asset streaming on the new hardware, which replaces the infamous multi-minute installations of the original PS3 release, and you don't just present it as a benchmark, you present it as a victory over proprietary confinement.
Exactly how it should be done. By explicitly connecting the Switch 2's asset streaming back to the preservationist movement fighting the digital terms of service, the technical data becomes narratively urgent.
Suddenly you actually care about the specs.
Right. The reader suddenly cares deeply about ARM64 instructions because those specific instructions are what rescue Hideo Kojima's cinematic masterpiece for future generations. Emulation is no longer just a technical upgrade. It elevates and liberates the art beyond the limitations of its original era.
It gives the silicon a narrative purpose, and tying the hardware specs to the human element is just one method to maintain narrative focus.
What else were you thinking?
Well, the author could also structure this emulation section chronologically, detailing the specific technical roadblocks the preservationist faced as a series of escalating narrative conflicts.
Oh, treat the bugs like villains.
Exactly. Framing the technical hurdles as antagonists in a story structure keeps the reader highly invested in the engineering solutions. Both methods ensure that the technical data serves the broader narrative, rather than pausing the narrative to deliver a lecture.
That's incredibly effective.
Okay, let's synthesize what we've covered today. We have three primary actionable suggestions for the author to implement in their next draft. First, bridge the thematic gaps between the consumer gaming transitions and the aerospace engineering sections by explicitly comparing their underlying architectural philosophies, specifically the overarching transition from monolithic fragility to decentralized resilience.
Right.
Second, expand the analysis of the physical disk phase-out by actively introducing and systematically dismantling corporate counterarguments, mapping out the long-term economic implications of artificial digital price floors.
Don't forget the PC parallel, too.
Yes, absolutely. And third, anchor the deep dive technical emulation specs of the Switch 2 to the broader ideological stakes of cultural preservation, framing the engineering data not just as a technical feat, but as a crucial defense against media extinction.
By making these high-level structural and thematic adjustments, the author will transform a collection of disparate intelligence items into a truly cohesive, compelling narrative about how human engineering and consumer rights are adapting to systemic vulnerabilities.
We highly encourage the author to take these editorial strategies back to the drafting table, implement the adjustments, and submit their revised work back to the show for another critique. Because when we examine the shifts happening across both consumer hardware and aerospace engineering, the underlying lesson is undeniable. Massive, inflexible systems that refuse to adapt are incredibly vulnerable to sudden disruption.
Beautifully said.
By fortifying the connective tissue of this document, the text itself becomes just as resilient as the decentralized networks it aims to describe.